Okay. Hi and welcome everyone. I'm Stacey Barr, the performance measure specialist of StaceyBarr.com, and welcome to my free September 2007 teleseminar on how to measure anything, which is an exclusive interview with Douglas Hubbard. The total call, it will be about an hour, and over this time, I'm going to be asking Doug some questions about his very lofty claim, one he's been making for many years now, that everything is measurable. Now, while I'm not sure that even I'm convinced that's true, honestly, I don't think that's going to matter one little bit. The diamond in Doug's claim is not that absolutely everything is measurable, but rather that many of the things that we believe to be immeasurable actually can be measured meaningfully. Now, we'll introduce Doug properly in just a few moments. But for those of you who are new to my Measurement Handy Hints e-zine or have joined this call through a friend or a colleague, welcome aboard. And just in case you don't know much about me or why I'm so passionate about something so dry as performance measurement, let me quickly explain. My career began as a research statistician in the early 1990s, and I helped clients to collect and analyse survey data for decision making about all sorts of things, as varied as the profitability of sheep farmers, a recreational boat ramp usage, and even Grand Prix car racing. But I quickly discovered that it's not numbers and analysis I really love. What I love is having objective feedback that helps you focus on and improve the results that matter most for your business. And that's been my specialty for about 14 years now, helping people in business use performance measures to focus on what matters most and stop wasting time, money, effort and energy in reaching their goals and targets. More specifically, making performance measures easy to understand, very practical and people-friendly is what my job's all about. Now, I'm really excited to introduce my guest today, Douglas Hubbard, President of Hubbard Decision Research. And Doug's calling in from Illinois. Is that where you are right now, Doug?
Yes, the western suburb of Chicago.
Western suburb of Chicago, there you go. Doug is author of a very recently released book, How to Measure Anything, Finding the Value of Intangibles in Business. He's also the inventor of Applied Information Economics, or AIE, and that's a measurement methodology that's earned him critical praise from the Gartner Group, Giger Information Group, and Forrester Research. He's an internationally recognized expert in the field of IT value and is a popular speaker at numerous conferences. Doug's written articles for Information Week, CIO Enterprise, which is where I actually first discovered him in 1997, and DBMS Magazine. Doug was formerly with Coopers & Lybrand and has over 20 years' experience in IT management consulting, including 12 years' experience specifically in teaching organisations to use his AIE method. And that's actually been applied by dozens of large Fortune 500 IT investments, military logistics, venture capital, aerospace, I think that's pretty exciting, and also environmental issues. Welcome, Doug. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Stacey. Glad to be here.
Wonderful. Now, hearing all those bits in the background, we're certainly getting a lot of callers coming in, so nobody be too distracted by that sound. That's all it means.
Well, I was going to impress everyone by actually counting as we went along here, but I lost track while you were talking. So.
Well, okay. I'll be able to report that number back to you, Doug, after the call
anyway.
I'm always interested
in that sort of stuff, yes.
Lovely. You're not one of those people that walks down the street and counts windows in the buildings that you're going past?
Not all the time, no.
That's good. I won't be worried. Doug, as I mentioned before, I first discovered you back in 1997. An IT officer in the organization that I was working in at the time, he handed me a copy of your article, Everything is Measurable, which was in CIO Magazine. What really caught my attention was what you called your clarification chain, and I have to admit, I have used that a lot over the years with my clients. It just explains measurability really, really well. I'm wondering, would you mind sharing with all of the callers what the clarification chain is and maybe expand on it a little bit?
Sure. Well, it's both an argument for why things are measurable as well as a tool that you can use. I mentioned a few steps in it. One is, if something is important, it must be different in some relevant way. Now, imagine someone saying that employee empowerment or strategic alignment or customer satisfaction are important, but they're completely unobservable. They're indistinguishable from having it or not having it. That wouldn't seem to make sense to most of us, that if it's something important, we must be able to detect it somehow.
Yeah.
So that brings me to the second one, is that if it's different in some relevant different way, it's observable. So if it's better, it has to be different. If it's different, it has to be observable. Now, what's interesting is that this is actually contrary to some very important heroes for statisticians and metrics people. Deming, you recall Deming?
Edward Deming, yeah, W. Edward Deming, father of quality.
Yes, that's right. He actually said the really important things can't be measured, and I disagree with Deming in that respect. If it's important, it must be different in some way for the organization that is observable. Now, if it's observable, it's observable in some amount. And if it's observable in some amount, it can be measured by definition. That's the clarification chain. If it's important, it's different. If it's different, it's observable. If it's observable, it's observable in some amount. And finally, being observable in some amount is what we mean by measurement. So once you figure out how you actually observe this thing, why do you even think it exists? Why do you think that it's higher in some cases than other cases? Fill in the blank with anything, strategic alignment, quality, customer satisfaction. You think it's higher in some situations than it is in others. Then ask yourself, what are you observing that's telling you that they're different? Well, usually we can find some observations, and as soon as you start to put your finger on that, you're well on your way to designing a measurement for it. That's the clarification chain.
Absolutely. It's wonderful. I love its simplicity, but it really focuses us, I think, to a great extent on the way we use language, particularly in our business plans and in writing goals. Our language isn't specific enough to be measurable. It's very fluffy and woolly and inert.
Oh, absolutely.
What you do with the clarification chain, I think, is start us there. It starts us with, well, what is this fluffy language that we're using and how can we unpack it and make it specific and observable? It's very, very powerful.
Oh, sure. I hear it I hear it all the time. That somebody will say that there's something that's really important to them, that's something they would like to track or learn more about, but it's immeasurable. And once you go through the clarification chain, that just seems like an oxymoron. It just seems like if it's immeasurable, that means it has to be invisible to the extent that you don't even have a reason to believe it exists in the first place. If you think it exists at all, it's because you've observed something about it. You've come to some conclusion, some observations. Then it's just a matter of structuring those observations. That's what scientific method is all about, structured observations.
That's fantastic. So, Doug, has the clarification chain been a tool that you've used regularly with your clients through the years? And if so, how have you actually used it with them?
I suppose it becomes subsumed in the way that I facilitate workshops. We have to define and clarify what this problem is. And I'll find myself asking bits of the clarification chain whether or not I'm always going through the exact same four steps. But I'll ask people, you know, why do you care about this? What's different about it? What do you see when it is different, et cetera? And why do you think it's higher over here than over there? And then once they start to talk about some of those concrete examples, they invariably end up defining measurable aspects of it.
There's some powerful questions in what you've said there, a really good list of prompts that people could, you know, almost have a little kit bag of those sorts of questions when they're looking at their goals and saying, well, how can I measure this? They could be pulling out those sorts of questions. How do you know it's different? How would you know it felt better? You know, how I think in your article actually you referred to imagining two organizations identically the same, but one organization has the result and the other organization doesn't. Can you expand on that a little bit more as an example?
Yeah, I actually talked about that in the article and in the book as a type of thought experiment. And the idea behind the thought experiment is that if somebody says, you know, pick something really intangible, something extremely difficult to measure, let's say leadership.
Good.
Okay. Organization A is exactly like organization B, except A has a little bit more leadership in it. So what are we looking at when we actually see the difference? What do we see when we see the difference between the two? Would there be any observable differences at all? Well, I think a lot of people would agree that leadership does have observable differences. And since leadership has observable differences, have you ever said this person's a better leader than that one? Or one person is a good leader, another person is not a good leader?
Yes.
We must have made observations to cause us to come to that conclusion. And once we can sit down and sort of classify those observations, we can even take something like leadership or vision or quality and things like this and define them in measurable terms.
That's excellent. That's fantastic. So that's probably a good tip for everybody, is that it's to maybe create a list of questions or scenarios or ways that you could explore where you're having the difference, where you're having the result, and where you're not having it, and really explore different dimensions of, well, what's different about the place that does have it versus doesn't.
Exactly.
Thanks, Doug. That's lovely. Now, what, I mean, the whole reason for the clarification chain, its purposes for existing is the fact that lots of people say, you can't measure that, that's too intangible, that's immeasurable, there's no way you'll ever be able to track that. These are questions that, or statements I should say, that come up very, very early in almost every assignment I have in working with my clients. They come to me with that, not even with the open mind, they come to me with this idea of, you can't measure this. It's almost like a challenge.
Sure.
I'm certain you've come up with that as well. Would you like to share some of those sorts of issues that you've faced with your clients about measuring the immeasurable?
Well, like you said, with the clarification chain, you know, many of the responses I use now are almost scripted. I could almost write another book just on the scripted response I get to many of these objections, because I really hear the same categories of objections over and over again. In fact, in the article and in the book, I identify there's only three reasons why anybody ever thought something was immeasurable, and they're all three illusions. So these are the three reasons. You might recall these, but I talk about them as howtomeasureanything.com, C-O-M, concept, object, and method. They misunderstand the concept of measurement. They might think that a measurement is an exact quantity. That's not really what it means in any of the empirical sciences. Measurement means observations that reduce uncertainty about a quantity. That's what it really means.
Yeah.
It's the uncertainty reduction is the key part of this. If somebody says, well, I can't get an exact quantity about this, and therefore it's immeasurable, if that's what measurement really meant, then lots of things would be immeasurable. But there are a lot of cases where we can make observations that reduce our uncertainty from what it was before. And uncertainty itself is measured statistically. Right? The width of a 90% confidence interval, for example,
yeah,
or the probability of some event occurring or not. Our uncertainty is expressed in terms like this when we speak in those probabilistic terms. And when we make observations, we can change those ranges and probabilities. And that's a reduction in uncertainty. So that's the first thing. A lot of people, if someone thinks something's immeasurable because it's not an exact quantity, they just didn't understand what the definition of measurement was. And I talk in the book a lot more in depth about some of the nuances of some of the empirical definitions of measurement, et cetera. But secondly was what we were talking about with the clarification chain, the object of measurement. Someone might think something's immeasurable just because they don't really know what they mean when they said it. And this is really the beginning of the clarification chain, right?
Yeah.
Someone says, I would like to measure performance. How do you measure performance? Well, what do you mean performance? What's an example of high performance? What's an example of low performance? What do you see when you're looking at a high performer versus a low performer? Basically, identifying, clarifying, defining the thing that you're looking at, that you're trying to measure. I had one person in a seminar I was given give me an example of a difficult measurement for this very purpose. He said, mentorship. I said, oh, mentorship, that sounds like something very interesting, sounds like something I would like to have more of in a company, have good mentors in a company. What do you mean by mentorship? And he said, I don't know. I said, well, that's the source of your measurement problem. That is, you have to figure out what you mean when you use these words. But as soon as you figure out what you mean, you can define measurements for it.
This is why I think every good measurement conversation, every good measurement process begins with a conversation that doesn't even talk about measures. It talks about the results
of the Exactly. It starts with, what do you mean, fill in the blank?
Exactly.
And then you just put whatever word fits in there.
And don't bother going any further until you actually have figured out what that thing is that you want to have more of.
Yeah, exactly. The obstacle is not its immeasurability, but a person's ability to articulate what they're talking about. That's the obstacle. It's not the whether or not it's immeasurable once we figure out what they're talking about. The third thing that's really the only other obstacle to understanding why everything is measurable is methods. There are a few basic methods of measurement, and most empirical scientific measurement methods come into a sort of a combination of these two basic methods, and I talk about them in more detail in the book. But the idea that, say, conducting a controlled experiment would tell you something about whether or not your customer retention increased as a result of this IT project. Have you ever heard this? That,
yes.
You know, an IT project makes a claim about sales.
Yes.
And then sales goes up or down as whatever it does, right? And then someone says, yes, but how much of that sales was due to this IT project?
What's its contribution? Or how
right,
much
what's its contribution?
To it?
Mm. Right, well, isolating the effect of individual variables in complex systems, that's what most of the empirical sciences are about. And doing using methods like controlled experiments and regression models are exactly what that is all about. So isolating the effect of a single variable when there's could be dozens of other things or even hundreds of other factors that you haven't even identified contributing to something like sales, that's exactly what you can do with better familiarity with methods.
Sorry, Doug, I was just going to explore on a bit of an example there. If you were to want to determine if an IT project actually did have an impact on sales, you'd want to make very certain that the sales team weren't modifying their selling process in any way at the same time, or that they weren't changing the product lines that were being offered, or they weren't entering a new market, you want to keep those things as constant as possible, so that you were really trying. The only change you were making was about the IT project. That's kind of what you mean about the controlled experiments.
Well, you could do it that way. That's kind of the hard way. I say in the book, the first method you think of is usually the hard way. If you think a little longer, there's an easier way. Most organizations, if they're of any size, they have a rollout period for an IT project. There's some region or line of business that has it before other regions and line of businesses, right? So a lot of people get stumped because they're thinking they have a before picture and an after picture, and that's all they have. I say, no, you've got dozens, maybe hundreds of data points here to look at. You have, by week, each of these line of businesses or each of these regions or each of these cities where you have offices, et cetera, you have their weekly sales and how it changed as the IT project rolled out to them. You could even correlate it to their adoption rate, how many users started getting on it at that period of time. And if you could do a regression model or even just plot it out and just look at, say, here's the increase in adoption rate in these different lines of businesses or these different regions, and here's how sales changed as it came on board. And if you start seeing those plots come up in something close to a straight line, you say, wow, what's the chance that this could just be coincidence, that the increase in sales in each of these areas happened to coincide with when we rolled out the system? Now, in some cases, the sales will be a little higher than in other places because there's normal cyclical differences, there's business environment differences, et cetera. But if you could see a change in sales that could be isolated to the rollout schedule of the system, well, then you have lots of data points to make this on. You don't have just two.
Absolutely. And, I mean, just that idea that a lot of people will just measure the before and the after, they won't appreciate the value of measuring historically and regularly through time. So you do build up that body of data that you can look for patterns within. One of my mottos is it's the patterns, not the points, that really give you the information about what's going on with performance. So.
Oh, that's a good motto. I would say even that the idea that if you're going to claim that, say, an IT project had some effect on sales, it's not just an increase in sales that you should see, but how did that increase happen? Did it happen more in one department than another? Is it happening more with the sales reps that are using the system more than the sales reps that aren't? You should see certain patterns in how the increase occurred, not just the increase.
Absolutely.
So anyway, that sort of deconstruction is really essential to all of this. You know, sometimes I think that if a lot of business professionals were on CSI, if they didn't see a videotape of the crime and DNA evidence, they would think it was up in the air, right?
Yeah.
No, you have to use a lot of clues. and you have way more data than you think, and you probably need less data than you think. I say that over and over again in the book.
It's just wise words. But the second part of your third point about measurement, Doug?
Oh, no, I was simply going to point out a couple of measurement methods that, you know, maybe a lot of people didn't know you could do. Like, for example, how does a marine biologist estimate the population of a fish in the ocean?
Not
or in a lake?
Swimming and counting, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, they say, well, I asked people this, how would they do it if it were in a particular lake? And I say, well, how would your average accountant do it? I maybe there's some accountants on the phone call. I apologize in advance. But sooner or later, someone would say, drain the lake. And I say, yes, the accountant would drain the lake to count the fish or to measure the population of fish. Because when you ask the accountant to measure the population of fish, they thought they heard count instead of measure.
Uh-huh.
So they assume those are synonyms. They're really not. But a marine biologist would do something called catch and release. You cast a net, catch 1,000 fish, tag them all, throw them back, and then you get them all mixed up with the population again, cast a net again. Let's say you catch another 1,000 fish, and of those 1,000 fish you caught the second time, let's say 50 of them are tagged. Do you have enough information to infer a 90% confidence interval for how many fish are in the lake? Yes. It's about 20,000 fish, and it's somewhere between 15 and 25,000 when you do the math on this. But if your previous range was 5,000 to 50,000, that's a much narrower range. And that's called catch and release. So that's how you can actually estimate the size of populations when you never see most of it. That's how they estimate the number of species of butterflies in the rainforest. They know they haven't found all the species. How can you estimate the number that you haven't found? It's really the same statistical methods that the Census Bureau uses to estimate its undercount.
It's
how does the Census Bureau estimate the number of people it missed counting?
Okay.
Well, it's a simple statistical method. They don't actually do catch and release, tag them, throw them back. But they use other statistical methods. And you, by comparing the results of different statistical methods, you can estimate the total size of the population that you didn't see with either statistical method.
That's amazing.
So it's really amazing what has been measured with methods like this. Good sound measurements, too.
Sampling very much relates to the last point that you've made about understanding populations without, you know, draining the lake, so to speak.
Right.
And something I think is very underutilized in organizations, too, is instead of sending survey forms out to all employees or to all customers once a year because that's all they can afford, going with much smaller samples and measuring more frequently can actually give them much, much more valid and much more useful information.
Well, absolutely. And it depends on what you're doing with it. But if you're measuring something where you currently have a lot of uncertainty, chances are very few samples will reduce your uncertainty a lot. And that's the interesting apparent paradox with sampling, is that the less you know now, the more the first few samples will tell you. So if you have no idea what percentage of time your customers spend doing activity X, if you say, gee, I think it could be, I don't know, 0 to 60% of their time they could spend in some activity that's related to this. I really have no idea. Well, then you sample the first 8 people and none of them said they spend more than 5% of their time on it. Well, you could probably get rid of that upper bound after 8 people. I mean, you could work out the odds that you would just by chance happen to have chosen 8 people that spend less than 5% of their time doing this if, in fact, more than 50% of their time was spent doing it for the population on the average. So that's why there's these small sample statistics. So the less you know now, the more the first few samples will tell you.
Which is a revelation.
Right. I mean, people think, how can I learn anything from 12 samples? That doesn't make sense. I say, well, here, try this. I have this example in the book, the jelly bean example. You know, I ask people for what their 90% confidence interval is for how many grams a jelly bean weighs on average. An average jelly bean.
Okay.
And they might, in the past, they've given me ranges of something like half a gram to 10 grams. And I say, all right, I take one jelly bean, I put it on a digital scale. I actually did this for the book. And it said 1.4 grams. Would that change your range? Most of them rationally choose to greatly reduce their range as a result of that first sample. And that's rational. That makes sense that they should do that. They went into that sampling with all, they already had some ideas about the relative uniformity of jelly beans, et cetera.
Yeah, so they could correlate that with other information they had about the
jelly beans. Yes, exactly.
So this is an important point then, is that distinction between measurement and counting.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you think more about what measurement means, you're thinking more about, well, it's about reducing uncertainty. It's not about knowing precisely or knowing with absolute certainty. It's about reducing the uncertainty in our current understanding of something. And that really does broaden the scope of how useful and applicable measurement can be in a lot of different situations versus the counting.
Oh, exactly. You know, when I was doing my research for the book and I went back and looked at my 1997 article, I was shocked to see that I actually, in the clarification said, in the clarification chain, I said, what can be observed can be counted. I think I said something to that effect. What can be observed can be counted, what can be counted, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And I wouldn't say that anymore. I use the words count and measurement very differently. So that's one thing that's changed about the clarification chain. Counting is in the same sense that everybody understands the word to mean, is, you know, you're actually doing it a piecewise, you know, identification of each item, and you're saying you're counting it up as integers. Measurement is very different. Measurement is what are the odds of getting this result if, in fact, this were the underlying state of things? That's what statistics is about. You say, what are the chances I could have gotten if I'm measuring the height of the average Nebraskan and I randomly sample 20 people, what's the chance that I could get an average in that first sample of 20 of 5'9" if in fact their average height was over 6 foot? It's pretty low actually when you work that out if you're using random samples. And that's what most sampling theory is about here.
That's great. The title of the book is a really interesting and provocative one, I think, How to Measure Anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that in putting this teleseminar out to my list and just getting some of their responses to it, a few emails popped back saying, no, you can't measure anything. And I wonder if they've missed the point a little bit about what this book really is about and what it does mean to measure anything. What gives you the confidence, Doug, to make a lofty promise like that?
Well, it's simply because every time I've seen someone claim that something can't be measured, which has been for the last 20 years of my management consulting experience, it has, in fact, in every instance, turned out to be measurable. And in every instance, it turned out that they simply misunderstood one of those three things I just talked about, concept, object, and methods, without exception. And then I just started realizing, you know, if I stood back for a moment here and look at the basic argument that some things are immeasurable has to be based on the idea that if it's not measurable, that means I can't observe it at all. Now, with sampling theory and things like this, we understand that if you can observe it at all, there's a way to structure the observations to tell you more about it than you knew before. That's a measurement, okay? On the other hand, if someone says, this is important, but I can't observe it at all, I would say, why do you think it's important then? Why does it matter to you? I mean, if somebody says, I can't measure, you know, the hair color of leprechauns, I would say, well, is it observable in some way to you? Does it have any consequences to you in some way? They would say no. I said, well, that's why, you know, you can't measure that because it's irrelevant. It has no bearing on reality. If it's something you believe exists at all and you care enough about it that you try to measure it, well, then you've made some observations about it already that tell you that it exists. You've made some observations that tell you that it matters. So we work through that thinking, and we start to identify observations we can make to reduce our uncertainty.
I guess that conversation at the beginning would vary in length depending on, on the person, depending on the organization, depending on how complex it was, the thing that they were trying to measure. Do you find that?
Well, usually it's almost a script now for me. I simply identify which of the three things they misunderstand. or multiple of the three things they misunderstand, and I explain it to them.
Yeah.
Once I realize that if it matters to them, it must be observable, and if we can observe it, we can start to structure observations, then there's really nothing left in the argument that some things can't be measured. And by the way, in the book I describe things about how the government and often damage claims in civil trials measure the value of the human life. I've even used the measure of the value of a human life in ROIs for IT investments.
Seriously?
Seriously. That example, that case study, is in the book, by the way. The value of human life, by the way, if you want to know the answer, it's between $2 million and $20 million. It's a range.
Is that right? Oh, wow.
Yeah. You know how they do that?
No.
They look at how you spend your own time and money to figure out how much you value your life. It's called VSL, Value of a Statistical Life. It's a methodology that's actually widely used in a lot of different programs. You ever heard of this? Maybe we hear these advertisements all the time in the States. I don't know if you've heard of them in Australia or not. But there's this heart scan. You get this heart scan, you come into a local hospital, you get this heart scan. It can detect if you have any, potentially fatal problems coming up.
Okay.
And they have people come on the heart scan advertisement, and they explain, if I hadn't had this heart scan, I was otherwise healthy, but I had this heart scan, and it found something that, fortunately we caught it in time, and it saved my life. So let's take it for granted that those claims are true.
Okay.
I think they are. I think they are true that people have come on board and said, this found some problem, some defect, and it would have been deadly in a couple of years. And fortunately, I was able to have surgery that saved my life, and I only discovered it because of this heart scan technology based on MRIs. I know a lot of people who haven't done it, and I haven't done it either. I chose to save my time and my money instead of getting the heart scan, even though there is some small fraction of a percent chance that it could have saved my life. Maybe I'll be dead in a year, but only because I didn't get this heart scan done, right?
Yeah.
But I chose to save my few hundred bucks and my time, a couple hours, 3 hours or so with the commute and everything to go do this. And when you look at a bunch of purchases like that, you could change the tires on your car more often and be a little bit safer. You could get a third smoke detector in your house. Now, you may not consciously make these trade-offs, but when you look at a large number of trade-offs, it's rational for someone to say, look, I'm not going to value your life more than you value your life, and apparently you value your life at between $2 million and $20 million. And that's actually used by almost every federal agency in the United States that has something to do with public safety, like the FAA, the EPA, FDA, et cetera.
Really out there, that example.
Yeah, it is. But the fact is that you can't get around not putting a value on that because you have limited resources and you have to allocate them in some way.
That's
we
exactly
could
right,
right now in this country and in every country in the world, they could save more of their citizens' lives if they raised taxes a little bit and allocated them towards some safety program. You could do that right now in Australia.
Hmm.
If you paid more in taxes, it's conceivable that you could afford more safety programs and you could save more lives. How do you think an increase in taxes of, say, half again would go in Australia?
Right now, I'm not sure that any increase in taxes would go down.
Exactly. Even if you could save an extra two lives a year.
By the time
a program starts to get to the point where a human life has to be worth $100 million to justify the program,
yeah.
Well, then you can say, well, gee, that same money could save more people somewhere else. So you can't get around the cold, hard economics of the fact that you have limited resources and people choose that there's some point of diminishing returns on how much they're going to pay to save someone else's life or even their own. And that's the value of VSL, the value of statistical life. And that's actually in the cash flow of ROIs that I've done in IT systems for the federal government.
There's a corollary to this, I think, Doug, which is not being able to measure something perfectly is no excuse not to measure it at all.
Yes. The existence of noise is not the lack of signal.
Yes, that's beautiful.
The existence of error does not mean that you won't learn something. You have more error now. Think of uncertainty as error, right?
Yeah.
If you were to estimate something now without making any measurements at all, you'd have a lot of error, right? If you had to measure, say, the performance of someone in an organization and you haven't made any observations at all, if you just did an estimate, basically you'd be a guess, you'd have a lot of error. Well, whatever measurement method you've come up with would probably have less error than that. And that's what measurement means, right? That's what we meant by measurement in the first place, the reduction of uncertainty.
Exactly, which gets us closer to being able to make a slightly wiser decision.
Yes, exactly. It doesn't matter that we haven't eliminated uncertainty. It's that we have less uncertainty, and that's so key. It always gets back to those things.
I was just going to say, Doug, to the callers, a lot of the performance measurement meetings that I've participated in with executives or managers or decision makers, so many of them, they're sitting there looking at their performance reports with performance measures. They're spending more time debating the integrity of the data or the integrity of the measure, not actually seeing what value they can get out of what that measure is offering them. That's a behavior I think we really need to become more aware of and shift so that we think more in terms of the glass is half full with this measure as opposed to half empty. This measure has something to tell us. What can we get from it as opposed to just discounting it totally because it hasn't got 100% integrity?
Yeah, exactly. That's an extremely irrational behavior that happens a lot in business.
Mm.
They'll throw out any uncertainty reduction they have at all because it's not 100% uncertainty reduction. You know, I can improve your bets at the blackjack table by 50%, and if you play all night, those averages level average out such that you're making a lot of good money. But someone would say, well, you're not making it perfect. You're not making all these predictions perfectly on the next card, so I'm not going to take your information at all. That doesn't make sense. Nobody would do that, right? But we do it all the time in business.
Yeah, it's crazy.
We say, here's this information about this study or this performance metric, et cetera. Because it has some error, it has no utility. It hasn't had any error reduction at all. And that's a fallacy.
Absolutely. Doug, have you got any more examples that you can share about something maybe related to IT or related to some of the other things you've mentioned, like leadership or employee performance, that kind of illustrate this process again of how something traditionally considered immeasurable actually has become measurable?
Oh, sure. Well, you know, let's take something really fuzzy like IT risk.
Right.
Right? That seems really fuzzy and
yes.
Touchy-feely, right? Well, I mentioned in one of the four maxims I talk about in the book, two of which I've mentioned. One is assume it's been measured before. Assume you have more data than you think, that you need less data than you think, and that the measurement is cheaper than you think.
So these are good attitudes to start out with.
Right. These are good attitudes to start out with because we usually end up making the opposite, highly unproductive attitude.
We do.
Which is we assume that it's never been measured before. If we figured out how to measure this thing, we'd win a Nobel Prize because no one else on this planet has ever measured this, right?
Yeah.
That's the attitude we're starting out with. And we also start out with the attitude that we don't have the data that we need and we're going to need tons of data. Usually the opposite is true. And finally, we start out with the assumption that anything that's going to be a useful measurement is just going to cost too much or be infeasible for some reason. All of those turn out to be unproductive assumptions. They have not made any measurements to come to those conclusions at all. There's a lot of error in those measurements. They have more error in their judgments about measurement methods than the measurement methods would. Right? What measurements did they use to come up with those judgments? None.
None.
Exactly. So all it's based on my experience. You mean your non-random sample of experience? Right?
Yeah.
Right. It's not like they were doing the math all the time. People don't remember things. They don't remember the standard deviation of their experience or the mean of their experience.
Oh, heavens.
They just remember a bunch of anecdotes.
And sometimes it can take just a sample of one for them to draw that conclusion, too.
Yeah, exactly. What they tend to do, in fact, this is what's been determined in years of decision psychology research, decades really, what people do is they remember the times they were right. That's what their statistical analysis of their experience comes down to, is remembering the times they were right.
That's a worry.
Yeah, isn't it? That's why they're statistically overconfident. I talk about that in the book, too. People put very high chance of being right on subjective odds. If they're making a prediction, they'll say they're 90% confident. When you track them in reality, they're only right 60% of the time, but they say they're 90% confident. The first thing was that about measuring out T risk. The first thing was to assume that you weren't the first to measure it. What else? Who else measures risk all the time? Actuaries.
Absolutely.
We should be doing what actuaries do. We don't have to invent a scoring system for measuring risk in IT. Risk to an actuary is the probability and the magnitude of a loss. That's what risk is about.
The
probability of a loss and the magnitude of a loss.
Okay, good.
Putting those two dimensions on risk.
How likely is it going to happen and how big it is when it happens.
Yes, exactly. And that concept is just as relevant to IT as it is to, computing the premium for insurance policies.
Yeah.
Or insuring, the failure of a rocket launch that's carrying an expensive satellite, things like this. The actuaries, by the way, do a lot more than just insure things that have mortality tables for. They insure very difficult to predict events. Actually. Take it for granted that risk has been measured before and that you don't have to invent any risk measurement method.
Right.
That's the first thing. So when we talk about measuring the risk in IT, and I spend a whole chapter on measuring risk in the book, we do it with Monte Carlo simulations. By the way, I'll do two or three or half a dozen Monte Carlo simulations in the morning. Okay? Before 11 a.m., I'll do that many. They're not difficult things to do. I knock them out all the time. There's a lot of tools out in the market for doing these sorts of things.
Now, do you need to be a statistician to learn these things? Can the book help people come to an understanding of what a Monte Carlo simulation is, how it's useful, and give them enough knowledge that they know who to go and see to have this sort of thing done and why?
Oh, yeah. In fact, the book has a website, howtomeasureanything.com, and I actually give people a simple spreadsheet-based example of a Monte Carlo. It can't be any simpler than that.
Right.
It's just Excel. It's just a combination of formulas in Excel randomly generating a bunch of scenarios that were defined in the book. So, and once someone sees how simple it is, they can kind of take it from there and figure it out for themselves.
Right.
So that's what we talk about. That's what we mean by measuring risk, is we're figuring out what's our uncertainty about these things. Can we quantify our current state of uncertainty? And how much would we lose if we turned out to be wrong? And that's what we mean by measuring the risk of any investment.
Yeah.
Including IT.
It's nice and straightforward.
By the way, you do have a lot of empirical data, by the way, as well. Just to take one example, IT projects cancel with some regularity. It's not as if there's no data on this at all. The Software Productivity Research Institute has data on this for a few decades, actually, at least the last 20 or 30 years. The Software Productivity Research Institute, I think it's still SPRI or SPR.com. It's either SPR.com or SPRI.com. But they've got this empirical data on the failure rates of IT projects. Well, those cancellations, where you've spent some money and then someone pulls the plug before you finish, that happens some percentage of the time. And one of the best predictors is the duration of the project. If a project is about a year long, about 14.4% of projects cancel that are a year long or longer.
So there's
data on that.
Data.
So you don't have to wing that even.
Okay. Thanks, Doug. That's great. Now, we're starting to draw close to time for our callers to ask some questions. But before we do that, I'm wondering if you wouldn't mind maybe summarizing some practical tips that people can start doing straight away, immediately after this call, so that they get a better crack at measuring what they've up till now believed to be immeasurable.
Oh, sure.
How could you summarize some tips for them?
All righty. Well, first off, define this thing. What is it? That's the beginning of all scientific knowledge, right?
Yeah.
Is it defining what it is you're talking about? Secondly, figure out how to quantify how much you know now. There's almost nothing you need to measure in this world that you don't already have some idea about. If somebody said, well, you know, has the performance of this group of people improved this year or not, and by what percentage? They wouldn't say, I'd have no idea. They'd say, well, it can't be the case that their performance has improved by more than double. It can't have gone down by half. That doesn't make any sense.
Okay.
In the book, I call that the absurdity test. At some point, you know the value is absurd, and in between the two absurd points is your range. That's what you know now. Where the absurd starts to become unlikely but feasible, that's the bounds of your knowledge. Okay?
Right.
So quantify how much you know now. In the book, I actually show methods for training people how to quantify their current uncertainty about things so that they get good at it, so that they can put odds on things. It turns out some people are very good at putting odds on things. Bookies are very good at putting odds on things, it turns out to be.
Yeah,
and if you can learn to be as good as a bookie, well, you can when you read the book. You can learn to be as good as a bookie at putting odds on things. And then you ask, why do you care about this? And when does it start to make a difference? What would you do, for example, if you were measuring some group's productivity and the productivity was lower than you expected or higher than you expected? What would you do that would be different? And what is the point at which you'd begin to do that?
Okay, so this is like the implication. How does this, would this actually drive me to some sort of action?
Yes, exactly. So then you're really starting to describe the framework of the measurement when you're doing this. You're saying why you care about it. There's some threshold at which some action will engage when you measure this thing. And sometimes you find out that threshold might be pretty far away from where you think it is now. And so that might even simplify your measurement problem. So as soon as you sit down and quantify where that threshold is versus what your current uncertainty is, you might say, well, gee, it's either very unlikely or very likely that threshold could make a difference here. You know, am I going to be high enough on this performance increase that their bonuses kick in? Or is it going to be low enough that I should fire the manager or something like this? There's got to be some observable consequences for it.
Right.
And finally, you know, master a few basic empirical methods. The great Yogi Berra quote I was telling you earlier, Stacey,
yeah.
If I heard this before I wrote the book, I would have left it in the book. But Yogi Berra said, it's amazing what you can see when you look.
I love it.
Quit talking about the limitations of whatever measurement method you're trying to use and start making the observations. You might be surprised.
Absolutely.
And you know what? People usually are, because we find out all the time that people are, if we can get them to start making observations and get out of the conference room and talking philosophically about the types of errors they think it might have, using their very erroneous judgment about statistics, right?
Yeah.
They get out into the world and start making some observations, they'll start to learn a lot. In fact, there's one really important concept that I talk about in the book that I mentioned in a later article in CIO Magazine called the IT Measurement Inversion.
Mm-hmm.
That is, there's a formula for computing the value of information. It's been around for almost 60 years now, and it's widely used in a variety of fields. And it's odd, but IT almost uniquely doesn't know that there's a formula for the value of information.
Wow.
It's used in government, it's used in business, it's used in portfolio management, the Census Bureau knows about it. There's 1,300 statisticians working in the Census Bureau. That's the most statisticians I've ever heard of in any organization. They were a client of mine. They have 1,300 statisticians. How many of them do you think measure risk in IT? None, of course, just like everybody else in the world. So even in those areas, they've got all this understanding of the formula for the value of information. But there is an economic formula for the value of information, and in some cases it's very simple. It's more like the cost of being wrong times the chance of being wrong. If you want to boil it down to its simplest possible cases, there's some more complicated examples. But when you work out the value of information, it turns out you end up measuring completely different things than you otherwise would have.
Is that right?
Yes, and I talk about that in the article, The IT Measurement Inversion. In the book, I just call it The Measurement Inversion because since I wrote the article in 99, I've applied this to many non-IT investments and problems, including forecasting fuel for the battlefield for the Marine Corps. And it doesn't matter what area I applied it to. It turns out the highest value measurements are routinely the things that people never thought about measuring. And the things that they spent all their time measuring so far were among the lowest value measurements. So we call that the IT, the measurement inversion. what we used to call the IT measurement inversion. And it turns out that if you start making observations for things that you've never observed before at all, you're almost always going to have an epiphany. In the book, I call it the epiphany equation, the formula for the value of information. It's called the epiphany equation because you're just much more likely to have an epiphany if you look under a rock you've never looked under before. And you're probably, if you haven't done the math on the value of the information, it's highly unlikely that by chance alone you've chosen the highest value measurements to make. You probably haven't. Yeah. You're probably measuring all the wrong stuff just like everybody else.
All the stuff that was easy, all the stuff that was traditional, all the stuff that everybody
else
measured.
Yeah, exactly. People measure what they know how to measure, not what they should.
Absolutely. Well, we're just about ready to take questions, Doug, but while everybody who wants to ask a question sort of gets their question framed nicely in their heads, I'll give them a couple of minutes to do that. Maybe you could share with us how people can get a copy of your book. Where do they go?
Well, it's been on Amazon for a while, but you can go to Amazon.com. You can go to howtomeasureanything.com. That's the book's website. And it also has all the downloads for spreadsheet examples I talk about in the book. Those are all free. Anybody can get them. They make more sense if you read the book first, but you don't have to buy the book to download the spreadsheets, actually. I have examples of calibration questions there. I have a forum there. I also have a measurement challenge in the forum, and that is where people try to come up with very difficult measurement problems, and we discuss them.
That sounds great.
So I encourage you all to participate if you can.
Wonderful. So that's howtomeasureanything.com.
That's correct.
Okay. Well, I'll mute the call, the lines now. And if anyone's got a question for Doug, please just say your name and go ahead and ask your question. So let's unmute. Great. Who has a first question for Doug?
Hello,
Francois. How are you doing?
No, fantastic. You can just imagine how excited I am about this talk. Doug?
Yes, I can.
Thank you.
I'm so glad about the book, and I'm so glad of how clear you are. But I must admit that it's sometimes quite an upward battle to convince people you can measure everything. So I'm really looking forward to get hold of your book and dish it out to some clients that give me that argument. I'm definitely going to keep some of that.
Well, you know, and I do make a distinction there. You make an interesting way of phrasing that, because I don't actually tell people to measure everything. What I tell them to do is I ask them to apply this value of information formula, and then they actually end up measuring very few things.
Yes.
What's interesting is after they apply that formula, they end up measuring just a small fraction of what they thought they should be measuring, because it turns out that only a few things really matter. Which, you know, kind of makes perfect common sense, but, you know, when we design performance metrics and all sorts of things, we feel like we have to measure everything, and it turned out that most things that we would like to measure don't really have much chance of having bearing on a decision. So I say that everything is measurable. I don't necessarily say they should measure everything.
I think I have to admit that I've made the mistake in the past to try and convince companies to measure everything, and obviously that wasn't a good strategy.
Oh, yeah. There's very few things that matter, and what matters is usually a surprise when you do that calculation of the information value. So take it for granted that most people aren't very good at guessing what they should measure. I don't even try to guess anymore. I just wait to see what the information value calculation says, and then I say, aha, okay, now that makes sense. I should measure that thing.
Brilliant.
But for everything that we choose to measure from the information value calculation, everything that it indicates we should measure, there's a dozen other things we could have measured that we didn't.
That's got to be encouraging to a lot of people, because this is one of the problems that most people face, particularly in large organizations, is they are drowning in measures that are meaningless. So that there's a lot of hope in that, I hope, for people. It's about finding, you can find the most meaningful nutshell of measures, if you like, as opposed to measuring a plethora. Thanks, Francois, for your question or your comment.
Well, Francois, did you have any other questions? Francois? I guess not.
No. Anyone else got a question?
Chris, go ahead. Sounds very good, and I like the sounds of it. But in small enterprises, how to make the measuring cost effective so that small businesses can take advantage of the same?
Well, I have a small business. My small business is my wife and I, and sometimes a few subcontractors. And so we have a very small business. I gather it's probably smaller than yours. Is that right?
Yeah, well, a bit bigger than that, but yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, I apply these methods all the time. So if we find them economical, then you can probably find them economical. The point is that first, people don't really know how much they should be spending on measurements. So you don't really know until you figure out how to compute the value of information. It's only then that you can figure out, this measurement right here is worth, you know, $2,000 a year to measure. Can I reduce my uncertainty on this for less than $2,000 a year? And most of the time you will probably say yes. I can make some observations that tell me more than I knew before. So again, there is an economic argument against measurement sometimes, and that can be a legitimate argument. There's a lot of measurements that aren't economically justified in making. But in fact, most people are too quick to say that measurements are uneconomical. They haven't figured out what the measurement is worth from its decision value with the formula for the value of information. And they haven't actually sat down and done any analysis of the cost of the measurement. So they don't really know for a fact yet that a measurement is uneconomical, that they can't do it. So I would say, you know, let's learn how to do that math first. Work out the cost of a measurement and the value of the measurement, and make sure that the value is a lot higher than the cost, and then it's justified, even for a small organization.
To some extent, there's going to be some action learning in that as well. I mean, you have to, if you haven't really taken measurements seriously in the past and haven't really done it before, you do need to appreciate that you will need to put some time into doing a bit of that learning and, you know, figuring out how to do these value calculations and maybe looking at measuring a couple of things, bringing those measures to life, and through using them, learning that and fine-tuning it over time.
Exactly. And I have on the book's download website, I have some simple information value calculations on spreadsheets. So it's not that hard to learn.
Right. That's
taught a lot of people.
Doug, we're coming close to the call. I'm just wondering, have you got time to hang around for another couple of minutes to maybe take one more question?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
Great. Thanks for your question, Chris. Has anyone else got a question?
Hi, Doug and Stacey. Martin's my name.
Hello, Martin.
You hear me all right?
Hi, Mike.
Actually, I've just been listening quite intently, and it's interesting. I just... having just finished a project and coming to the realisation that as a project manager, often you don't have necessarily sufficient input into the business case, and it's the underpinning assumptions around the benefits which underpin a business case, which is really the key to, I guess, getting funding and all the sorts of things that often are a dilemma. In this particular instance, it's interesting in that you know, what's emerged was that the project was delivered, saying that the outputs of the project were delivered, you know, on time and pretty much on budget, which fell into my responsibility. But when it came to looking at the benefits and the scorecarding activities, so, you know, you can probably guess what I'm going to say. But what's finished up is that, you know, the benefit measures are sort of cluttered in this noise, that's associated with these, and I sort of call them masking events. As a consequence, when you look at the overall justification, it's simply not there. And now we're in a situation where, you know, you're rummaging around trying to, I guess, re-engineer the process. And what ultimately will have to happen is we've got to go back and find some more CapEx funding to initiate some further system changes to, in fact, be able to, you know, to derive those benefits. I guess the learning and all that for me was to get an absolute understanding of what the underpinning assumptions are, and it's really, the question is when you get to the measures and actually start measuring, it's too late if you're measuring the wrong things or you find that you can't actually get the data that you need. And and I say I work for a very big organisation, I won't say who it is here in Australia, but it seems to be the dilemma that I think many project people face. When you get to the end of a project, you need to try and, I guess, justify why you've actually done it.
Well, you said several things, Martin. That I can respond to.
This was an IT project.
Yes, an IT project. Great. One is you talk about assumptions in the business case. As I discussed in the book, when you use Monte Carlo simulations, that's where you generate thousands of random scenarios to simulate the outcome. In Monte Carlos, you don't use exact numbers. You only use exact numbers when you know a quantity exactly. So how many of those benefits quantities do you think they knew exactly when they made the business case?
Certainly, I think there was because it was really based on gathering data out of reporting systems, the question was they I guess made some assumptions that it really wasn't based on simulations. I guess it was
right, exactly.
Based on
they probably didn't know any of the numbers exactly, right?
I'm certain of that. I'm certain.
Right. They put exact numbers in the business case, but they didn't know the answers exactly. What I say is with Monte Carlo is you don't have to make assumptions about exact numbers, because you don't need exact numbers in a Monte Carlo. You put in ranges, and then we use those ranges to generate simulations. The fact is that you didn't really know that the ROI was going to be 58.2%, right? In fact, it's highly unlikely that it would be exactly that. It's probably going to be something else. What you really knew about those benefits is that they were in some range. And then once you've identified what that range is, you can say, what kind of observations can I make now that would reduce my uncertainty about those ranges? So I don't even use the word assumption when I make business cases, because I don't want people to make any assumptions. I don't want them to state anything as a fact that they don't actually know. And if you can do probabilistic modeling, you don't have to state anything as a fact that you don't actually know. You
That's
don't even
relief.
Have to assume. You don't even have to assume you're going to finish the project. You can put a chance that it's going to cancel before you finish. You don't have to make any of those assumptions. Instead of assumptions, use ranges and probabilities. That's the first thing. Secondly, you mentioned something about tracking benefits after the fact. We talked a little, I think we addressed this a little bit earlier, about separating out the impact of individual variables, and that much of scientific method is about isolating the effect of individual variables. You talked about these masking events, but in fact, it's not just the value that should change with these masking events that you talked about. It's that how that value increased and with what specific pattern it increased, if it were due to one thing and not another. So it's always that next level that you can get into. You also mentioned that you worry about getting the data, and I always tell people again, you've got way more data than you think, and you need a lot less data than you think. That's not the data is not the issue. The issue is how clever we are, resourceful we are in terms of getting the data and what data we really need. And what was the last thing you mentioned that was a very interesting? Oh, you mentioned the scorecard. I don't use scorecards. That's a pseudo measurement. That's something you use when you don't know how to measure something. So you make up a scorecard and you feel like it's more like a measurement because there's numbers in it, but it's really not. There's actually been a lot of research in decision psychology about the use of scorecards and weighting systems, and there's certain kinds of weighted scoring systems, and that's what it is, right? A kind of a weighted score.
Yes, essentially. I mean, it's a legacy from the past that
it's
changing.
All righty. Well, there's been a bunch of research about whether or not weighted scoring systems like that actually improve decisions, and it turns out they usually don't. There's only a few examples where they actually improve decisions, and those methods have some very specific properties that almost no one ever uses. Like, for example, normalizing the data on each of the parameters, you know, so that they're all expressed as a what they call a Z-score. And that none of the parameters are these ordinal scales where you weight something 1 to 5. Is that what you do? You weight something? You score each thing as, say, 1 to 5 or 1 to 10, and then you weight it and add them up?
No, not specifically in this case.
Oh,
that's certainly
okay. Yeah, it's what happens a lot. And in those cases, those are the very kinds of models that the track records show in every case where they've measured it just don't seem to improve decisions. So don't use a scorecard if you can get by with it. I wouldn't use it at all. There's some other much more meaningful measure to use. There's some actual observable unit of measure that you can use. There's nothing that you need to assess the scorecard that can't be better assessed with other unit of measure definitions.
Okay, thanks very much.
Okay.
I think that's going to be it for questions today, Doug. So what I'm going to do is just mute the call again and we'll wrap this thing up.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Okay, Doug, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today and especially for sharing so many great tips on how to make things measurable. I certainly got a lot more out of it myself than I had expected. I really appreciate it. And I reckon we're all going to think twice now before declaring something to be too intangible to measure.
Well, I appreciate your time. I hope I didn't get too wordy on some of the responses.
Oh, no, it's fine. It sounds like
a big topic.
It is a huge topic, and to squish it into an hour until our question time is no mean feat. So hopefully everybody's going to be going and visiting howtomeasureanything.com. Thanks, everyone, for joining us on the call today. The call recording is going to be available in a few days. We'll email you a link when it's ready. You'll be able to download it or listen to it online. And, Doug, I think you're going to be putting a copy of it on the book's website also?
Yes, I will.
Great. Well, I'm looking forward, everyone, to sharing lots more practical performance measure ideas and tips with you in the coming months that are going to help you save time, effort, money and energy in your business organisation by measuring the results that matter most. In the meantime, feel free to come visit me at www.stacybarr.com, StaceyBarr.com. And if you're not a subscriber already, you can sign up for my twice monthly free email newsletter, Measurement Handy Hints, at www.mezhermnt.com, which is pronounced measurement.com. And yes, I do realize that's not how you spell measurement. I'm just liking to have a little bit of fun. Thanks, everyone, for joining the call. Thanks again, Doug.
Thanks a lot, Stacey. Appreciate it.
And everyone, have a great day. Bye.